By now, you've gotten used to hearing news about the Elliott State Forest in Coos and Douglas counties near the Oregon coast. The situation there is unique because the state wants to sell the forest into private hands. The Elliott is supposed to make money for the Oregon Common School Fund. Instead, it's been losing money, so it's for sale with one bidder showing interest. The Oregon State Land Board meets today to consider the sale. Jess Burns is with the Earth Fix unit in our newsroom, and she's here with some news of the Elliott dealings. Welcome, Jess.
Hey, Jeff.
So what is on the schedule specifically today for the Land Board?
So they are going to actually get a report from the head of the Department of State Lands, just basically going over what is in the bid, whether or not the bid meets the protocol, which we have heard that it does, basically the terms that the state has put forward for sale, and where improvements could be. And then the state is, and then the members of the land board, the treasury, the state treasurer, the governor, and the secretary of state are going to basically give their feedback and give the Department of State Lands kind of direction about what they want to negotiate for, other possibilities potentially going forward. There's going to be some public comment. And I think we're going to get out of this without any kind of vote up or down on this.
Well, I was wondering about that, particularly because since it is governor, treasurer, secretary of state and treasurer are both short timers out the door in a couple of weeks. Have they decided that it's probably best left to another land board?
No, it's not that at all. It's the way they set it up a year ago, that if they only received one vote, that means it doesn't actually have to go
one
to
bid?
The land board. One bid. It doesn't actually have to go to the land board for approval. The Department of State Lands can just kind of move forward administratively with it. And my sense is that unless the land board says stop or do this, that this sale will just like chug right on along until negotiations are final and potentially there's a closing next December. Now, I don't necessarily think that's going to happen. I think there are going to be some caveats that come into play just from based on what I've been hearing and what I know about the situation. But I think that without any kind of input, the Elliott State Forest would be sold.
You've been reporting on the Elliott for a while now, to put it mildly.
Yes.
Set us up for this feature we're about to hear.
Yeah. So what I decided to do here is we hear a lot of, I feel like there's some amazing journalism out there in the state about, these are the people opposing it. These are the people that are wanting it. These are the options they have. I feel like this kind of he said, she said kind of situation is there. What I really wanted to do with this is bring people to the forest, bring in kind of a unique organization I don't think we've heard about on this that are positioning themselves kind of uniquely and just kind of give people a sense of what's at stake.
So we really get a chance to hear, in a sense, the Elliott State Forest.
Magic of radio.
We're slowly winding along the narrow gravel roads of the Elliott State Forest. I'm with Allison Tarbox and her colleagues who do stream restoration work for the Coos Watershed Association. Tarbox has a CB radio in hand, tuned to the local channel.
9.5 up the 2,000.
Every half mile, she calls in our position to give logging crews working nearby a heads up.
10 up the 2,000.
We pass pull-offs full of beer cans and smashed pumpkins. Farther on, a burned-out trailer is still smoking slightly, adding to the natural fog of the Coast Range. Roadside clear cuts alternate with thick forested stands. Tarbox, now on foot, leads us deeper into the forest. We push aside bare salmonberry canes with our forearms to avoid the thorns. Elk tracks lead to a stream and a deep pool of salmon.
You see them? There's one right in the front right here. It's one of the lighter ones.
These coastal coho are at risk of going extinct.
And then kind of where you see the reflection of the alder, you can see a couple tails moving.
Meeting the needs of people and the non-human residents of the Elliott has not been an easy task. After generating timber revenue for decades, the forest took a $3 million hit in 2013, and the outlook hasn't gotten much better since. Now the state is moving to get out of the Elliott business. They've offered the forest for sale, 84,000 acres, for $220 million. There's been one proposal to buy, a joint offer from Roseburg's Lone Rock Timber and the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians. Allison Tarbox and the Coos Watershed Association, or CWA, have been watching the story unfold from inside the woods, knee-deep in the West Fork Millicoma River.
That sand is super soft. Don't fall.
Although the state has put several environmental stipulations on the sale of the land, the forest protections could change if the sale goes through.
I feel like there's always going to be that possibility with a transfer of ownership.
But CWA has decided to remain neutral.
Our one goal through this process is to work with whoever is going to be owning that land. We just want to keep doing what we're doing.
Because there's a huge amount to be done. The Elliott isn't pristine. Early timber crews altered and scoured the rivers to transport logs. Up until the 1970s, state game officials moved down trees in a misguided effort to help fish migrate. CWA projects have moved large logs back into the water to create fish habitat. They've also opened culverts and other barriers that prevented salmon from passing upstream.
All right, so this bridge is pretty slick, and then the next one right after is kind of loose.
One of these projects is at the end of this wet trail to Stulls Falls. Water rushes over a series of low, wide waterfalls. Lovely to view, but not so great for fish. Salmon would bunch up right below the upper falls with nowhere to go.
So they would try to jump on this bedrock sheet, so it would just be flopping on the slab. It was really sad to see. I saw it a couple times.
The CWA crew came in this summer and cut three small channels. Now we only see one salmon in the pool below the falls.
It's a fish.
Perhaps waiting for some privacy before making the final acrobatic push upstream into 16 miles of now open spawning habitat. It's this kind of boots in the water work that Tarbox wants to continue doing in the Elliott.
We love working up here because we've had so much success and we want to keep that going.
But to do that, they'll need the goodwill of the owner, whoever that happens to be. I'm Jess Burns, reporting from the Elliott State Forest.
Jess Burns is part of our EarthFix unit, so she actually works out of our newsroom here at JPR, and she's my guest here in the studio on the Jefferson Exchange. Interesting phrase at the end there, whoever that happens to be. For a while, did it look like nobody would bid on the Elliott State Forest?
You know, I think the exact opposite. I think it actually looked like there were going to be several bids. At the initial meetings about whether people were interested, dozens and dozens of groups showed up from environmental groups, from, you know, industrial timber companies, the tribes, all across the board. And so I think there was a real sense of surprise that only one bid actually did come in. And this is a joint bid, as I mentioned, from Lone Rock Timber Company, which is a timber management. They own land. They're out of Roseburg. And the Cow Creek Band of Umpqua Indians, they would be the minority share in the bid.
Very minority, 87 to 13, I noticed, yeah, is the amount of money they're putting in.
Yep. And then they've brought in, the bid also brings in I'm blanking on the tribe. I want another tribe in the area to manage the conservation easements, and then other groups that are part of it as basically consultants, mm-hmm, about how to go forward with,
yes,
the land.
Other conservation, mm-hmm, groups involved, and on, mm-hmm, behalf of other tribes in the region. We were hanging out with the Coos Watershed Association. First, on a personal level, it must have been nice to get away from some of the facts, the figures, the bids, the land board representation, and just get out there and experience the Elliott.
Yeah, definitely. It's a working forest, and so there's stark contrasts everywhere you go. But it is, you know, quite beautiful. The watershed is really vibrant. There were coho. I had never seen coastal coho personally, and so that was a very exciting thing to see these endangered fish looking pretty happy, looking pretty healthy on their way upstream to spawn. And the Chinook had already gone through. And so, yeah, it was great. And just to see the projects that this group had actually done. I mean, they are seriously in the rivers pulling logs in. They are, you know, cutting channels and keeping these watersheds. And that's why it's so important for them to basically not make any enemies in this process, because, you know, though I'm sure individually they have preferences about who they'd like to own the land, as an organization, they want to work in the Elliott. And if they alienate anyone, then who ends up owning the land, then their work may get shut off. And for them, the work is the most important thing.
So the Coos Watershed Association, yes, needs to work with whoever is going to be,
yep,
in there.
Yep. Exactly. And they have a long record of working with timber companies and the state and just private landowners. They work across the board.
Other groups have certainly weighed in on this sale and even the concept of the state selling off this much land. Is it 82.5? Is that what the figure is just for the Common School Fund part of it?
Yeah, about, I would say about 82,000 to 84,000 acres. Yeah,
mm-hmm. Well, it's a lot of acres. But mm-hmm. but so, and where is the general sense of where, particularly conservation groups, are coming down on this?
Well, they don't want it to exit public land. There's hunting and fishing groups that definitely want to keep it in public, just because usually private ownership means access is curtailed. Groups like Cascadia Wildlands have been fighting this the whole time. They're really concerned about endangered species protections. And, you know, when private, the forestry rules for private land are definitely more lax than forestry rules on state land. And so definitely there would be an increase in logging that happens if the sale goes through. There is one lawsuit out there that I think has a decent chance of affecting this whole thing. Basically, the Oregon Constitution or statutory law, there's a line in there that says the Elliott can't be sold. It's pretty plain if you read it. And Cascadia has sued over this, and you know they're waiting for the case was heard this past summer, and so they're waiting for a ruling. And that could have some big outcomes if the state comes in and be like, yeah, I mean, it just says right here that you can't sell the land.
That seems pretty clear.
It does. I mean, the state is arguing, has a constitutional argument that they're making, and so they're hopeful as well that things are going to go their way.
If the sale to Lone Rock and Umpqua, this grouping, doesn't go through, is there a plan B at the state?
I don't think there's anything steady. Like, there is anything solid in effect. I think that right now, I think A.1, if that's, it's not really a plan B, it's more a modification of plan A. The governor has made some motions that she's interested in using some of the state's bonding capability to basically invest in the Elliott and become part of this bid and maybe have the state retain ownership, just not in the common school fund where it's bound to make money. So she floated that during her budget speech earlier this month, and I expect that's one of the things we'll hear about at the meeting today.
All right. So as long as we have you here, mm-hmm. might as well gives us a chance to run another Jess Burns piece. We can have a Jess Burns double feature. So you've learned a lot about chainsaws, we understand.
Oh, I know. You've heard me talking about chainsaws for maybe a year now.
Our desks are 6 feet apart.
So yeah, exactly. Yeah. We have a series out right now. It's pretty fantastic, if I do say so myself. It's basically looking at the military impact of the environment in the Northwest, going back to World War II, going all the way up to today. We look at Hanford, we look at current base, we look at military testing, we look at ship breaking, ship plane building, and I looked at the chainsaw, how basically the war helped usher in this new, relatively new technology at the time, and basically made chainsaw the kind of the modern icon of logging, and how that came in and basically affect the environment for decades to come.
All right, here's Jess Burns' piece on the chainsaw.
Growing up, Paul Skirvin milked a lot of cows.
One side of the barn was filled with cattle, another side with horses. Then we got our first tractor, the horses went, so the other side filled up with cows too. So then I was milking more cows.
He lived on a small dairy outside of Portland in the 1930s and 40s. Skirvin was too young to fight in World War II. But soon after it ended, he got a quick lesson in economics. Skirvin and his older brother were hired to log off their neighbor's land.
We milked them cows all month and make about the same as we make a week of logging. The cows went real fast.
It was the beginning of a 50-year career in logging. And there couldn't have been a better time to get started in the business. World War II had revived the industry and pushed the chainsaw into the hands of the Northwest logger.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air. President Roosevelt has just announced.
During the war, the military needed wood, and lots of it, for barracks, ships, trucks, planes, bridges, and crates for shipping supplies to Europe and the Pacific. But there weren't enough loggers around to meet the demand, says University of Oregon historian Stephen Beda.
Loggers are exempt from the draft because the demand for lumber is so high.
The government also considered more extreme solutions.
They were almost going to use Nazi POWs to log in the Northwest because that's how much they needed lumber.
This was proposed by the War Labor Board.
But the union protested so vehemently that they never went through with this plan.
Chainsaws were around before the war, but they were two-man monstrosities, and there was some hesitation on the part of loggers to take them on, says Beta.
One of the things they complained about was the noise, that the early chainsaws were loud, they were nasty, they spit oil, they spit gas.
But with wartime labor shortages, more and more lumber companies started turning to this technology to speed up the cut. The sweet song of the handsaw gradually faded, and Northwest forests filled with the harsh buzz of the chainsaw. Chainsaw technology rapidly improved after World War II. In the late 40s, saws that looked closer to the modern chainsaw started to appear, thanks to the development of magnesium alloy, strong, light material.
The fact that, you know, a chainsaw now becomes a lot cheaper and a lot more easy to manufacture has to deal with this new industrial infrastructure created as a consequence of the war.
We got our first power saw then from Monkey Ward, I think it was.
Paul Skirvin's first state-of-the-art chainsaw came from the old department store Montgomery Ward. It still weighed around 60 pounds.
After you got a power saw, man, just zip it a lot faster, 10, 5, 8 times faster.
And this new speed and efficiency came not a minute too late. The historic wartime demand for timber was quickly eclipsed by the post-war suburban construction boom.
Some businesses are moving to the low-rent outskirts. And so are families, which can afford houses in the country. The trend is away from the congested center.
They hollered about progress, you know, but they kept building more houses, and you had to keep producing more because they built more houses. And as saws come into existence, well, man, it made you even more productive. Yeah, you do a lot more, shorter length of time.
Billions of board feet were being cut in the United States, and the Northwest took the lead, says historian Stephen Beta.
If you live in a house made in the 1950s, 1960s, I could almost guarantee it's Washington or Oregon lumber that built that house.
And it's the legacy of that massive cut, powered by new technology and fueled by post-war prosperity, that set the Northwest on an economic, environmental, and political path we continue to walk today. I'm Jess Burns reporting.
Jess Burns is from our Earth Fix unit. We share her with a bunch of other stations, but she is based in our newsroom here at JPR. I want to thank her for joining us today to talk about environmental issues, current, as in the Elliott State Forest, and not so current, as in the birth of the chainsaw.